Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Here's the question that we'll try to take up this morning in this part of the show. Should we be worried about the food that we eat? Certainly seems that on a pretty regular basis, we hear stories about contaminants in our food supply, things that can make us sick, that sometimes can end up in food products as a result of sloppy processing, or sometimes as a result of deliberate adulteration. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with William Helfrich. He is professor of food science and nutrition here at the University of Illinois. Among his research interests, food safety and toxicology. And we'll talk a little bit about perhaps some of the things that we think about, that we worry about when it comes to food safety, and whether we're worried about the right things and how to approach them. Be happy to take questions from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to call with questions. And I know our guest will do his best to give you an answer. If he feels it falls within his area, he will certainly do that. Questions are welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it. Yeah, we're on. We're ready to go.
Figure it out. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it'll be fun to see. I mean, I've not done this before, so I guess it'll be a learning experience.
Okay, good. Well, we'll try to not make it unpleasant. We were just sitting here talking a little bit before, and I started out by making the observation that within the last couple of years, there's been a lot in the news that has to do with food safety in a variety of different ways. So we have people who get sick because disease-causing pathogens end up in the food, because there are things like salmonella and E. coli in the food. Foodborne illness, people can get sick. We've also seen cases where there have been chemicals, toxic things that ended up being toxic, end up in the food. Could be there on purpose, could be there by accident. That's sort of another thing. And on top of all of that, then, people are just very, you know, very concerned about the impact of food on them physically. And they're concerned about trying to figure out what's good and what's, you know, what's not. And it seems that we spend a lot of time worrying about what we eat. And I guess here my big question is, are we worried about the right things?
Well, I think that, you know, usually what I try to do is I try to bracket things, and, you know, I do it in many parts of my life. But when I hear the term food safety, I usually will bracket into chemical food safety and microbiological food safety.
Uh-huh. Right.
And, you know, and those are really quite different. Interestingly, you know, a few decades ago, if you were to ask the general public what were they more concerned about, they usually were more concerned about pesticides and the like. But, I mean, if you're looking at what actually causes the most deaths, it's going to be the microbial issue. And I think that, I mean, and, you know, it's kind of pathetic, but over the last few months we've had, you know, the salmonella creep into the food supply in a place that it really normally wasn't expected. Usually we get salmonella contamination from our own kitchen or whatever because we're not keeping the counters clean or whatever. Mm-hmm. This was something that was in peanut butter and from a very, very large plant, and it ended up in products that literally, you know, had Fortune 500 labels on them that you normally think are safe. And I think that's why it became so devastating.
Well, and that, I suppose that tells you something, and something that I think people are increasingly aware of, and that is that the way our food system works now is that products produced in maybe one place or in a small number of places end up all over the country and maybe in this particular case in all sorts of other products. And that's, I expect that's something that people probably, you know, didn't think about that very much. You know, maybe that's been true since starting in the 1950s or even before, but just how one problem, one place could have an effect in a very, very large area.
Yeah, I mean, you think what, yeah, there's, you know, nearly 1,000 people affected by the salmonella issue. And then, I mean, I think it's 8, you know, individuals who have died. But it, the the part that's sort of heart-wrenching about it is that you don't even know that you're consuming the product. I mean, this one child in Oregon that was consuming, you know, he got sick. Parents, you know, were trying to keep him eating, so they figured out what he liked. He liked this crackers, and again, it was a name brand cracker brand, and so he liked it with peanuts on it. And so every time he'd get sicker and sicker, they'd give him another bag of crackers, and the poor child got worse and worse and worse. And mm-hmm. you know, Martha asked him this morning, "How did they figure out not to give it?" I don't really know, but interestingly, this child was actually one of the ones that was, you know, at Congress yesterday, you know, healthy, but it's pretty. You know, when it comes into a place that you don't expect it and it's coming at, you know, that raises some pretty serious questions. I mean, you know, is it the fault of the FDA, the fault of USDA? I think in general, the food supply that we have is really quite safe. I mean, and you can unequivocally say it's the safest in the world. And there's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But can people cheat? That's a real issue. And this, I think, was a case where that from what I can tell from the literature that's out there and what I've read, it appears that this was known, and that where yeah. that's where it's going to really escalate up and get a lot, you know, in the next couple of months.
Yeah. Well, that's the allegation. The charge has been made that the people who are running this place knew that they had a problem and that they continued to ship product anyway. I suppose, though, whether it's a case like that where a producer knows they have a problem and they say, well, we don't care, we're going to send out the product, or you have a case where there is some contamination and we've seen this. We saw this not very long ago. We had a problem with bagged spinach or perhaps with other kinds of fresh produce where it was somehow in the process of growing it. There was some contamination and that it was shipped and we didn't really know it at the time. Nobody, the people who were responsible for producing it, they didn't know they were shipping out a bad product. But we got a bad product, and again, in the same way, it went all over the place. So we had people who were getting sick widely scattered. So then for people like the CDC, there's this challenge of you have a person sick here and you have a person sick way over there and you have a person sick someplace else. To get to the point where you've got the data, you figure out, okay, people are getting sick. Why? Well, and then there's this long process of trying to figure out why. I mean, it's really very difficult to trace this down and then find out where it came from. So that goes to this question, well, can we ever have a 100% safe system? Can we have enough inspectors going around looking at fresh produce and all the various processors that make food products that we end up eating?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting. I mean, you know, 100% is not probably ever going to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that there was a scientist at the turn of the last century named Metchnikoff, and he was the one that actually won a Nobel Prize for the first discoveries of immunology. But he had a comment in his book, and it struck me, and I read it probably 20 years ago now, but it said that he wouldn't eat any food that he couldn't render safe by peeling or cooking. And yeah, and so some of the consequences we deal with are convenience. You want the lettuce in a bag or the spinach in a bag. You know, you want to eat fresh foods, but you don't want to be, buying them, at the perimeter of the grocery store. You want to be able to grab them in a real simple. You want to be able to grab them in a way that you can put in the refrigerator and keep them safe. And that the fresh produce is a real challenge because it doesn't wash well. I mean, you're not looking at a surface that is perfectly smooth, and you can't, you literally can't add, disinfecting chemicals to it. It just doesn't work. So I think that is a real challenge. But I think what they've done is a very effective job at reducing the contamination at the source. And I think that, the safety is, I think people are getting the safety issues. I think they're more and more comfortable buying the bagged produce and carrots or whatever.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting, as you said, though, that for the longest time, what we were told when it came to food safety, we were told about why people got sick. It really had to do with food handling practices on a very local level, either what we were all doing in our kitchens, how we were handling things, or maybe people who were maybe working in one place. Maybe they're working in a restaurant, or they were, you know, it's the old thing about the potato salad at the picnic that ends up making people sick. It was that kind of a thing that had to do with food handling on a pretty close to where the food was being consumed. And it seems now, though, that there seems to be more reason to be worried about what happens a long way away from the place that the food is consumed.
I mean, yeah, you say a long way away. I think, you know, if you're looking at, you know, chemical issues, I think the melamine issues that occurred in China are really quite disturbing. I mean, now there you have, you know, a real blatant, contamination issue that was actually just for profit. I mean that it went as far as the milk products that were getting into the chocolate, and I noticed myself I wouldn't buy, you know, a chocolate bar unless I knew exactly where it was made. Even the pet food, I threw away a bunch of pet food if it had gravy in it, because I thought it might have the precursors that they were using to make the gravy would have the melamine in it. You know, and that's for the cat. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I think the other issue that comes up is that these are pretty severely economic issues too. Mm-hmm. I mean, peanuts are down 30%. You know, when the issues happened with spinach, I mean, it devastated, you know, those valleys in California, because they just couldn't ship the stuff. And the same thing's happening now with the peanut farmers, and it wasn't their fault, from what I can tell.
Well, just I have a caller here. We'll get to them in a minute. But just one other thing, and this maybe gets directly to your particular interest about toxicology, and the kind of stories that we have heard about the chemical contamination that happened in China. It seems to me, now, I say this as not somebody who doesn't spend time studying this, but that we haven't seen stories about problems with deliberate adulteration of food products at this level. I mean, have we seen since the 19th century virtually? I mean, have there been other cases as big as this?
I mean, I think that the difference is, I think we're probably more healthy as a society, and when you do have a sick child, it gets your attention. Mm-hmm. So I think that might have been the case with the salmonella. And then I think with the melamine, that story is a pretty disturbing one when you hear it from the beginning, when you had, you know, it started in ways that you took a product, melamine, which was added to the milk so you could make the milk appear that it had more protein so you could dilute the milk. And then the compound that they were adding was a byproduct of, I believe, plastics making, and it was contaminated. It was contaminated with a product that was very precipitated when it got into the body, and that's what was causing all the damage in the kidneys. And, you know, when you read that, it is sort of heart-wrenching, the kind of pain and damage it was actually doing to the children. And that was all for profit, mm-hmm. You know, just to be able to sell more milk that had more water in it, and you couldn't detect it because the system was showing that it had significant protein in it based on the assays that were there. So, and I don't think we've had that in the U.S., I mean, you know, where you've actually had somebody, you know, deliberately altering a chemical for pure profit like that.
But I guess the thing that worries people is now that products like that are produced outside of the United States and come in the United States. And here, in this case, it happened with the pet food. Here we have products that are coming in from outside. And what sort of control do we have? What do we know about the quality of those products?
Yeah, I think that's the $64,000 question, and that is a major challenge to the Food and Drug Administration. That's been, you know, that really is sort of understaffed to enforce things. I mean, you know, the positive thing is that we've had such a good success rate, and I don't even know what percent of our fruits and vegetables are coming in from outside the U.S., but I think this time of year it's probably well over 50%. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you can analyze every component, and they do sampling of a certain percentage, and I think in general we've been pretty lucky with that.
We have a couple of callers here. If you will go ahead and put on your headphones there, that way you will hear them. Let me again introduce our guest, William Helfrich. He's professor of food science and human nutrition and also nutritional sciences here at the University of Illinois. He's interested in food safety and toxicology, also the effect of natural chemicals that are in foods on chronic diseases such as breast cancer. We'll talk a little bit about that here in the course of our conversation. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go first to a caller in Belgium. This is our line four, toll free line. Hello.
Oh, how are you guys this morning?
Good.
Great day. It's not snowing yet. Hey, no, you know, this is a good concern of mine. I actually have bought, even though it's more expensive, a lot more organic grown things, but I know this is probably old hat, but wasn't it last year they had a recall of all these tainted tomatoes and strawberries from Mexico? See, there's my concern right there. We seem to be buying food from countries who don't kind of adhere to the rules, so to speak, and we have laws and regulations over here, and it seems like, you know, if you buy it from some other country, they don't. And like you said, you don't have enough people to go around and inspect things. That's my biggest concern. I mean, I'm in the construction business, and I can tell you right now, there is a lot more stuff being put on the market to build houses that cause concern for me than I say some of the fruits and vegetables. But in general, I think as American citizens, we need to start looking at everything, not just food. We need to start looking at how we build houses and how we live our daily lives, because I just got through going through a recent death in a family of cancer, and it seems like it's a readily – every time I turn around, somebody's dying of some form of cancer. Well, how did we get so unhealthy dying of cancer? Everybody says we live to 75 or 80, but I see more people with more bigger hospital bills and things than ever before. Can you explain that? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
I think with regard to the food, I think that the best we can do is to just do just standard practices when you get the food home, to do the washing and the like, and you know, the other, getting regulation on construction products coming in, I think that's a little bit out of my scope.
Well, the thing, though, that we were talking just a little bit before we took the caller about the fact that we do get more and more food products from outside of the country, and at various times a year, you want fresh produce, you got to get it from someplace else, and that might lead people to be concerned about what kind of regulations there are in the countries from which those products come. At the same time, I think we'd have to say that in recent years, the problems that we've had with bugs, disease-causing bugs in food, like the bagged spinach thing that we talked about, that spinach was produced in the United States. It didn't come from outside of the country. And in fact, I think that when we've had these kinds of problems recently with produce, it's been with produce that was grown in the United States. So it wasn't like it was coming in from someplace else.
And I think the issue with the spinach is when that was identified, there was a very unified effort to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that – so in many ways it's sort of self-correcting, because nobody wants to be selling contaminated products and you try to keep the products safe. And I think the same thing with the products coming in from outside. As consumers, you really want to have this diversity in fruits and vegetables that you get, and it is very, very different than what was on the shelves when in the 50s.
Yeah.
And so you want this diversity, and the companies or the producers that are making it, you know, they want to make sure that it's safe, and they don't want to lose this market for mishaps. And I think even the companies that, when it's imported in here, when they get it, they're going to do some control on it as well. So I think some of it's self-correcting, but I think that the process that are in place, I think, you know, will work. But I mean, they have to be really followed at all levels. And I think where the issue happened with the peanut butter, I don't think they were followed.
Yeah. And the other thing that the caller's comments make me think in is that and it's reflected now in the growing interest in people for buying food products that are produced essentially where they live. You know, wanting to the appealing idea of being able to buy something from the person who grew it. I think that these kinds of concerns can only add to that and add to people's interest in buying locally produced products and even, you know, when you can, be face-to-face with the person that produced it.
But, yeah, there's no question you're going to get a better product if you're going to pick your own blueberries in the summer or your own strawberries. I mean, you can actually pick the best ones and leave the less on the vine. I think that's a trend, but I'm not sure what percent of the products that we consume are actually locally grown.
Well, I suppose that's going to be a problem. You live in central Illinois, you know, you can't get fresh produce locally grown in January. So that's a problem. We got some other callers here. Let's go to Urbana next, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi.
One issue. On the spinach, that was systemic in the sense that the contaminant was within the fabric of the spinach itself. You couldn't really wash it off because it actually was organic, if I remember correctly, because I think BBC did a thing where they went to the farms out in California and turned out the farm was basically down the watershed of a milk farm. And the feces from the cows were getting into the spinach, so washing it was sort of an irrelevant issue. Then I want to ask you something. I'm going to go back about 25 years. I had an uncle that had served in the Pacific during World War II and died of what Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, which is now called mad cow. And he worked for Hormel plant in Rochester, Minnesota in the kill room. And he was a qualified butcher and everything. And his disease was diagnosed by a man at Mayo Clinic who had spent some time in the Pacific and said, you know, studying what was then called mad Creutzfeldt-Jakob's or mad cow, well, later laterally in England called mad cow disease. And I was wondering if I spent about a year looking this up, looking at his, I had his death certificate, his diagnosis. He lived only about 6 months after the diagnosis. And I wondered, and I started looking through the death certificates in that area, in the Rochester, Minnesota area. And I found that people had died, they were diagnosed, you know, four or five men had died from what they just, you know, like they didn't do diagnosis as Creutzfeldt-Jakob or mad cow, but it was interesting because it found out that they were like kind of like described as nuts, you know, or, you know, I can't remember the terms they used, but I'm wondering if these people had worked in these kill rooms, had basically picked up this disease, but they didn't know how to diagnose it. So they basically were, you know, they were considered died of insanity and stuff like that. I'm wondering if you could, if there's any way that could be discussed or, I don't know, I could dig all that crap up. I did, but I'm wondering if the people were exposed to this in the 80s in the United States and no one knew about it. Could you comment on that?
Boy, I know a half dozen people that would be really good to talk to, and I'm not on that list.
Yeah.
And so, the mad cow issue in the U.S. is a pretty hot topic, I certainly wouldn't want to say something that I didn't know for sure.
Yeah. But, well, I'm just wondering because, you know, they thought that he had contracted in the Pacific because of the time frame, because he was in Iwo Jima. He actually was in Manchuria and fought, and I have a picture of him holding this Japanese battle commander's flag. But, you know, he's a really nice guy, and he just went, you know, basically went insane. And then when he died, and they autopsied him, and there it was. You know, he had this Creutzfeldt-Jakob, as they called it then. But then, you know, they didn't make the association between cows, because in England, you know, people had contracted this disease. You know, and I think maybe 20 or 30 people died or some people, you know, and it shouldn't be genetic or something like that, I'm not sure. But it was just very interesting because I went back, I just sort of, you know, made a nuisance of myself and called the local coroner's office and stuff because some of these people died and they were, you know, they didn't know what was wrong with them. And then, like I said, nobody backtracked this to them. I'm just wondering if they contracted it, and I wonder if anybody else got it. So I just want to let you know that. Thank you. Appreciate your work.
All right. Well, thank you. I know you said this is outside of your particular area of research. And the thing that we always say on the program is that any questions welcome, but all questions cannot be answered. So sounds like you would just say, this is not my thing and I don't want to make a pronouncement about it.
Yeah. And if he sends me a note, I'll be glad to put him in contact with people that really, that's what they do. Yeah, the work we do mostly is chemical food safety, and then what we've done over the last 15 years now is looked at compounds that are in the diet or when they're being made in dietary supplements and what kind of role they may have on, a progression of breast cancer in women that may already have breast cancer.
Yeah, okay. Well, and that's something that we want to spend a little time talking about. So let's go on to we'll go on to the next caller. This is Mohammed in line two. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I have a couple questions, but my first one is probably the easiest. If I bought some brand name applesauce, say about 4 or 5 months ago, and I got it out of the pantry to use the other day. It's the kind in the little cups that you would give to little kids to put in their lunch. And one of them is just black with mold and color all through it. So I'm not going to eat any of them. But now what does a person do with that to let this company know? I know if I take it back to the grocery store, they're going to throw it away and charge the company. But that doesn't really do anything. They may have a problem all over the country right now. How do you respond to that?
I mean, those that know me, when I go to a restaurant, I have no issue with complaining. So I think if this is beyond the expiration date, that's another issue. But
no, it's not. It's got a year on it.
It deserves to go back and use that as some of their follow-up. I mean, if you're not the only one that has it, but if everybody's throwing them away, there's no way you'd ever trace it.
Well, where do you send it back to? The grocery store is going to throw it away. I just know they will.
Usually like with the larger companies, there's an 800 hotline. I mean, the company I was familiar with a little bit when I was in Michigan was Gerber, and I was always amazed at how effective they were at making sure every bottle or every jar of baby food they had was X-rayed, they had documentations on every lot. If you called at 2 in the morning, there was a person that answered the phone that could pull up all the information. And I mean, maybe the applesauce isn't as detailed as a baby food company, but you'll get a very polite person on the phone, whether they can do something or not. I think that's another issue, but they need to know. And then, like I say, the same thing when you go into a restaurant. The quality of the food's not what you want. It needs to be changed.
I will do that. I never thought about just getting a magnifying glass and going over the package. My eyes are getting old. The other question I had is, I have, to my husband's chagrin, stopped buying ham and hot dogs and any sausage that looks pink and has nitrites in it. I heard a doctor who was a cancer doctor on this station not too long ago saying if there was one thing that you could do and change your diet and keep yourself healthier, he said, get the nitrites and stuff out of your diet. Now, are nitrates bad too, or is it just nitrites? Can you talk a little bit about that? And I wish somebody would produce processed meat without it so we could have something to eat that didn't cost $10 a pound at the health food store. And thank you. I'll listen off the radio.
Yeah. Okay.
The nitrites is probably a pretty good, place to make a point. You wonder, are the nitrites there to, make the meat the right color? And actually, they're there to prevent botulinum toxin, so if you're bracketing nitrites versus botulism, there's no question what you want to be consuming. So, I mean, you want to be able to have the meat product be safe. Now, the AICR, which is a cancer group, and also associated with the World Cancer Foundation, actually has put nitrites and cured meats is pretty high on the list of things that you shouldn't consume. But I think if there's a way to get around it, that's fine. I always ask questions that are a little bit maybe more broad when I'm trying to profile what you want to recommend. I mean, I look at probably the worst thing a person can do is smoke in terms of having a disease or inducing a disease that you could prevent. And then you start putting everything else in that picture. What about getting foods that are pesticide-free? Is, you know, relative to smoking, you know, the pesticide-free foods really don't even come onto the scale. Nitrites are probably on there, but they're not very, in my mind, they're not really high up on the list. I mean, they're, you know, when you compare that with getting botulinum versus nitrites. So if there's a real need to consume the preserved meats, then do that in moderation. But that, you know, that's been one that really has gotten a lot of negative criticisms with regard to cancer in the last year.
All right. Well, I hope that gets the questions of the call. We will continue. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. The other day I bought a pumpkin pie in a grocery store. These were displayed on counters. I wondered about the fact that they were not refrigerated. I asked the bakery person, how can you assure me that I'm not going to be poisoned in one way or another by eating this pie that has not been refrigerated? And the answer was that was not any problem until you opened the package. And, of course, it was in a hard plastic container. What can you say about this? I can't believe that it's really a safe product.
I probably wouldn't have bought it. If you wanted to be somewhat flippant, you could be like that congressman from Oregon that actually had all these bags of peanut-containing products that he wanted the person that owned the company in Georgia to consume. You might have just said, well, how about if you have the piece today first, and if you're okay tomorrow, I'll have the rest of the pie. But I think if you're concerned about it, it's just not worth it to even think about consuming it.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Next caller here is in Urbana, and this is line 1. Hello.
I'm probably bringing something up that's out of your field, but a very large part of our prescription medicines, the ingredients are actually manufactured overseas. In fact, I understand a lot of it is coming from China. And it seems to me there's probably very poor safety inspection for this material.
That is yet another different and yet related concern to some of those that we're talking about here this morning. It was not all that long ago, for example, there was a problem apparently with the drug heparin that's used here in the United States. And I think it's to prevent, do I remember this right, it's to prevent blood clotting, something like that. And one of the precursors for heparin was made in China, and there was a problem with it being contaminated. And I think at that point, probably people started to think more and more about the fact that medicines and the things that go into them are now increasingly they're produced outside of the United States, and this is an FDA thing. So this is different than what we're talking about with food, and yet the same sort of concerns apply about can we go and inspect foreign factories where they're making prescription medicines? Now, obviously, we can't. We certainly can't inspect them all.
Yeah, I think it comes down to that, this major demand for cost reductions, and then, where do you draw the line in terms of tolerating things? I mean, it's not just China. I mean, there was an issue with, and it wasn't a drug, but it was actually a dietary supplement. Tryptophan was being made by microbes, and they changed the process for making it, and it had a byproduct in it that actually caused several deaths in the late 80s. So I mean, it's not just Japan. And some of this is that, you go through this process of, at least with the Food and Drug Administration, if you change any process along the way in one of your approved products, you've got to, or approved drugs, you've got to go and reapply. And I think when you're starting to farm the stuff out to other countries, you really don't have the same control. So, I mean, hopefully the drug companies are doing some quality control on large batches and to see if there's something that's obvious. But again, some of these things are, you can't look at everything.
All right. Well, we're talking this morning, let me again introduce the guests as we're moving into about our last 15 minutes. We're talking with William Helfrich. He's professor of food science and human nutrition at the U of I, interested particularly in food safety and toxicology, and also in the effect of natural chemicals that are present in foods, the sort of effects that they have on chronic diseases. And we'll continue to take questions here. Next up, I believe, is Belgium. That's line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that it just really goes to the aspect of common sense. In this most recent salmonella outbreak with the peanut butter, one of the things that came out three weeks ago, and they were talking about, was that they said dog biscuits were at risk. Now, I don't know if you folks are dog people. I've had dogs for years. I have a lab, okay? I've got to keep the kitty litter box away from the lab, you know what I mean? This dog will eat anything. Most dogs I know will eat some of the most disgusting things, and they never have problems. I mean, they got stomachs like cast iron sleeves. Doesn't it make a little... It makes me wonder, why would you say you worry about salmonella with dogs when... I don't know if dogs can even get salmonella with some of the things they eat, if you see what I'm saying. I mean, they put warnings on there, but... Is it a logical warning?
I think that if you go back to the number of people that got sick in the U.S., it was that were diagnosed with the salmonella, and not to evade your question, but maybe answer it a different way, is that the number of individuals that got ill from the peanuts was fairly small. So what that tells me is that the ones that are getting ill are the ones that are most susceptible, and I think that that's the like I say, you've got a dog that's pretty much immune to everything because he's inoculated himself with everything or herself with everything. Mm-hmm. But I think because the number of individuals that really actually got sick with the salmonella was fairly small. I mean, it's really relevant to those that got sick, and I think it was most likely due to that there was probably some, enhanced sensitivity to that particular group. Or some, characteristic with the way they consumed a variety of foods.
So essentially what you're saying is maybe common sense plays a distinct part in this. You want to be careful what you eat, if you're healthy, and cook things properly and things like that.
Yeah, I know an awful lot of people that think cooking is a microwave. So
Okay. Thank you.
Well, and I think, though, in this particular case, one of the reasons that there was so much concern is, and I think that it's true when it comes to salmonella, is the people that are most vulnerable are the youngest and the oldest. And if people have their immune systems not functioning particularly well, that could be a particular issue. And that's why it's really sad. People were giving these products to their children thinking that they were okay. Or maybe some of this peanut butter, ended up in large institutional settings like nursing homes where it might end up with someone who was very vulnerable. So, someone who was middle-aged and in good health, maybe they could eat it and they could kind of shake it off. The problem is that there are some people who couldn't, and we know that some people actually died as a result. Well, let's go on. We'll talk with some other folks. Line number 2, I think, is Champagne.
Yes.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for being on the radio this morning. Interesting program, and just a couple comments for previous callers. It wasn't that long ago that a lot of people lost pets from contaminated pet food. I didn't have a pet at that time, but I do now. And the woman who wanted to know about contacting companies, I find that if I mail the product directly back to the company, I always get a response. There is an 800 number. But you can just, a lot of people can call numbers very easily and not tell the truth. But I think that companies respect more the fact that you went through the emotions and the trouble and the time to mail a product back to them that you found under par. And they've always been very gracious and often offer lots of explanations about their sanitary procedures and what measures they go through to try to guarantee the best, you know, quality product they can. My question is a very simple one. I don't know if I missed the beginning of the program. What precautions do you take personally to sort of safeguard yourself against these kinds of things that are in the food that we buy and eat? And then the second part is, does microwaving not kill bacteria? That's it.
I knew that was going to happen as soon as I said microwave. So touche. I think the problem is that it doesn't really uniformly do it, but I think it probably would kill it in general. But I think the thing that I'm probably one of the more particular persons when I eat, almost to the point that I make When Harry Met Sally movie look pretty conservative. And I think that I protect myself pretty much by being so particular. I mean, if I go into somebody's home and I see that they're not doing things in the way that I would do, you know, I just lose my appetite. But I don't think I'm the norm. I think that's
You know too much.
And with regard to, you know, I do try to buy fresh fruits and vegetables, but I don't think that there's, I mean, yeah, there is some risk with it because you really can't fully wash them like you would. And it is nice to consume them fresh rather than cooked, even though I would, you know, logically I know I should cook them. So, yeah, I think being particular and pretty, you know, willing to throw a lot of stuff away before I would sample it to see if it's any good is probably what protects me the most.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Georgetown, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you very much for an interesting program and very important on to get some other ideas. The one thing that the lady that called in and talked about, I'm on a cell phone. Can you hear me? Okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The lady that talked in and asked about the pumpkin pie, I rather doubt this, but you know you can buy bacon right now that's fully cooked. And you don't have to have it refrigerated, and because it's, if I'm correct, it's irradiated, and they are using that for some products. I don't believe that pie, and I'm like you. I would have not purchased that pie, but could it possibly be that was irradiated? I doubt it. And can you talk a little bit about what foods are being irradiated and what your comment is about them? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. I don't know. Is that something that you know something about?
Again, I have a list of 6 people or so that I would be better at than I am, and I don't know enough about it. I mean, to be quite honest, and I am familiar with the bacon, and it is virtually sterilized, and there's a variety of ways of doing that. I mean, you know, the half and half you buy it's not irradiated, but it's ultra pasteurized, so that it actually can stay on the shelf at room temperature, like in Europe. But here, I don't think the consumer would buy something on the shelf. So they actually do refrigerate it. It has a shelf life of probably 3 or 4 months, you know. But I think there are, you know, processing techniques that really can allow us to have food products that would be a lot safer. But I think we're starting to see them come onto the marketplace. But in many ways, with the irradiation, it's always been difficult to convince the consumer that they weren't getting radioactivity, and it's. And there's a very different process. There's radioactivity never touches the radioactive compound never touches the food. So I think I think the consumer just has a real hard time with that.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And again, we're getting into all sorts of things that are worthy of other programs. But in that particular case, I think people have said, well, here's this technology that could be used. Irradiation could be used, and we could kill E. coli and kill the salmonella. There'd be no problem. But they believe that if people knew that the food had been treated that way because of their concerns about the very idea of radiation, they wouldn't buy it, or a lot of people wouldn't buy it. And I think the manufacturers might say, okay, if I can do this without putting it on the package, can we do that? And if I had to say on the package, this food has been irradiated, people wouldn't buy it.
Yeah, I think there's probably more than one show that could be done on food perception and and consumption. I think that's a very, you know, that probably really quite interesting. But I think, you know, what drives people to buy stuff or not buy things is something that, you know, that the food companies don't want to lose market share. Yeah.
Well, and we're unfortunately getting to the point where the end, and I must apologize, because one of the things that we really wanted to try to do was to talk a little bit about some of the research that you have done. That's, again, sort of it's connected, and yet it's a little bit different in the sense that now people are they're interested in eating things that. So here we've been talking about worries that people have about eating things that end up making them sick. Well, also there are a lot of people who are interested in eating things to make them healthy. They're looking for things that have benefits, and there apparently are, you know, good reason to question some things for some people, whether in fact, you know, the things that they may be eating because they think they will be beneficial to their health, whether in fact they are beneficial.
Well, I think I don't think there's any doubt that consuming, you know, a significant portion of fruits and vegetables will contribute to health, whether it's cardiovascular disease or cancer. I think where the link that the public goes to is that sometimes it's not that easy to consume the varied diets, and then the assumption can be that, well, really the food contains components that are important, so why not take the components out, enrich them, and then not have to deal with consuming broccoli or soy or whatever. And I think therein lies a bit of the problem, because now all of a sudden you're taking the products out of the food, and it's really then no longer a food. You're getting dosages that are, you know, that are much higher. And they could actually be pharmacological effects that you're seeing. And you know, the regulations of these products is they're regulated as food, so the Food and Drug Administration can't really come into play as in terms of regulating their on the marketplace. They can't, if you're doing a new food additive. The Food and Drug Administration will regulate that. If you're doing a food supplement and there's a history of use somewhere, they really don't have a mechanism to regulate it. They do have the ability to come into play if there's been some very negative health effects. And interestingly, there's only been a handful, or maybe not even that, of products that they've actually had removed from the market. They tried to pull ephedra off, and they, you know, they lost the lawsuits, and it's back on the market, but there's such a good awareness of it now that I think that's self-correcting in some ways. But the other one was this androstenedione, that's a precursor to a steroid. Mm-hmm. And so that one, it has been removed, and I think it's staying off. But it's amazing how little ability they do have to pull something off. Their first recourse is to do a voluntary recall. I notice you're looking at the clock. So
no, go ahead. I just periodically need to check to see where we are with time. But I'm go ahead, please.
Okay, but I mean, I think the point that we've tried to make through our research is that there really is a difference in consuming a food, and just because a food contains a component, enriching the component, it doesn't end up making that component equal to what's in the food. And I think that you know, you're dealing with different pharmacokinetics. You're consuming a food over the course of a meal, whereas if you're consuming a product that's in a pill, you're consuming it literally over the course of a second or two. And I think that makes a very different issue, I mean, in terms of how you're exposed to it and what kind of effects you're going to have. But there's really, you know, there's no real, you know, long-term follow-up of these things when you're consuming a dietary supplement as a pill, like there would be if you were comparing it to a drug.
Mm-hmm. And just very specifically here, one of the things that you've looked at is the some of the chemicals that are in soy, and the fact that now here over the last few years, you know, there's been a lot of attention paid to this question of hormones and what happens in women after menopause when their hormone levels go down, and whether or not you can in some sort of a natural way supplement that by eating stuff that has chemicals in that are sort of in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, I think if you're just looking at, I mean, if you're looking at something that mimics estrogen that's in a plant, I mean, aren't you still dealing? My feeling is you're still going to be dealing with a lot of the same issues. If it has estrogenic activity from a plant and you're consuming it in a high enough dose, you're probably going to get the estrogenic effects. And that's what – and I think where it becomes really confusing is when you give an estrogen early in an animal's life or even some of the birth control issues that were done in the 60s, you actually have a reduction in breast cancer in the animal models and in women. But if you give the estrogen after a tumor is in existence, then you're actually doing negative issues with regard to the tumor. And I think the same thing that we've shown, at least in the animal studies, is that these dietary estrogens from soy can do a similar thing. So it raises some pretty interesting questions, because at one time in life it may be beneficial, at another time it may be detrimental. And if it was a drug, all that would be characterized with indications and contraindications. But with a dietary supplement, since they're regulated as a food, you don't get to put those kind of – you can't put a contraindication on a supplement because there's no indication on there, because that you can't make a claim on them in general.
Yeah. So that – I guess this leaves you with a thought, and here, again, we've got all kinds of material for other programs, is that this kind of tendency that we have of when we thinking of something as natural as being as good and problem-free – and that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and I'll leave you with the way I start my course, and I'll ask the question is, do you think the most potent compound that causes death, is it natural or man-made? And you know, the majority of the class will say it's man-made, but actually it's not. It's a botulinum is the one that can cause death the quickest. Yeah. And then I'll ask the question, what compound can cause cancer to the greatest extent? Is it natural or man-made? And the comment always is that, you know, these evil smokestacks are making stuff. Now, there's probably more of it, but the most potent chemical for inducing cancer in animal models is going to be aflatoxin B1. And so, and then you want to frame it to the point that it just is, and it's probably a terrible way to end this, but are those in your food supply? And yeah, that's where the source of them are. The aflatoxin is going to be in things like peanut meal and the like. Or corn, and you're going to have the same issues with botulinum toxin being in, you know, anaerobically processed or they would produce under anaerobic conditions, and so then you're trying to balance botulinum toxin off with nitrites, which was an issue a few minutes ago. So it's maybe not the best way to end it, but I think in general, you know, those are two things that we do a very good job of protecting from our food supply.
All right. Well, there we've got to end it for this morning. Our guest, William Helfrich, he's professor of food science and human nutrition here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.